Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Papal Prayers. Pope Benedict says he is praying for all those affected by the tragedy of the earthquake that struck the city of Christchurch in New Zealand. EFAD Insights. In a wide-ranging exclusive interview with the president of EFAD, the International Fund for Agricultural Development, we look at the current unrest in the Mideast and North Africa regions, rising food prices, how to persuade the young to remain in rural areas, and the moral imperative to end the scandal of millions going hungry in our world. And burning fuse. We analyse the causes of the unprecedented popular unrest that has swept across the Mideast and North Africa region and ask whether it could spread to other areas. At his weekly general audience, Pope Benedict said he is praying for all those affected by the tragedy of the earthquake that struck the city of Christchurch in New Zealand. Emma McCarthy reports.
On Wednesday, Pope Benedict XVI launched an appeal for prayer and solidarity for the victims of a devastating earthquake in Christchurch City on New Zealand's South Island.
At this time, my thoughts turn especially to the people there who are being severely tested by this tragedy. Let us ask God to relieve their suffering and to support all who are involved in the rescue operations. I also ask you to join me in praying for all who have lost their lives.
The Apostolic Nuncio to New Zealand is Archbishop Charles Daniel Balvo. He said New Zealanders are grateful for the Pope's message of solidarity and his prayers.
Many people remain trapped in the ruins, and some of the ruins have become dangerous. So it's difficult for rescuers to enter and to try to search for trapped people. The city is 80% without water. More than half has no electricity, so they have set up refuge centers. As far as the church is concerned, certainly the two historic cathedrals have been seriously damaged. The Catholic Church is mobilizing as it can, but the New Zealanders are very resilient.
Earlier in his catechesis, Pope Benedict XVI continued his series on the great doctors of the church, turning this Wednesday to the 16th century Jesuit theologian, St. Robert Bellarmine.
In the period following the Council of Trent, St. Robert taught theology, first at Louvain and then in the Roman College. His most famous work, The Controversiae, sought to address the issues raised by Protestant theology from a serene historical and theological perspective, while his most popular work remained his brief Catechism of Christian Doctrine.
Pope Benedict XVI added that St. Robert, who was created cardinal by Pope Clement VIII, spent his later years composing a number of works of spirituality which reflect his deep Ignatian formation, with its stress on meditation on the mysteries of Christ and the loving imitation of the Lord.
Rahimahullah wa tashaffa'a lahu marmarun.
Ti benediciamo, Signore, perché hai voluto arricchire dei doni dello Spirito.
Before arriving in the Paul VI Hall Wednesday, Pope Benedict had stopped to bless and welcome the first statue to represent a Middle Eastern saint to adorn a niche of St. Peter's Basilica. St. Maron was a mystic and hermit born in 4th century Syria. He is considered the father of Maronite Christians, which counts more than 3.5 million followers across the world. There to witness this proud moment was Cardinal Nasrallah Sfeir, Patriarch of the Maronite Church in Lebanon, accompanied by Lebanese President Michel Suleiman and a group of Lebanese ministers of all denominations. I'm Ema McCarthy.
The UN agency, the International Fund for Agricultural Development, or EFAD, has just held its annual meeting, which focused on how to support young rural people who will play a vital role in feeding tomorrow's world. The president of EFAD, Kanayo Wanze, spoke to us in an exclusive interview afterwards about a range of global issues, such as the current unrest sweeping the Mideast and North Africa region, how to persuade young people to remain in rural areas, rising food prices, and the moral imperative to end the scandal of so many millions of people going hungry, whilst 40% of the food in the rich world goes to waste. I began by asking Wanze what new insights emerged on the role of the young rural people at their annual meeting.
For some time now, I have been asking the question, who is going to feed the world in 2030, 2050, when world population will be at 9 billion? That means we will have another 3 billion people on our planet. And I've been asking myself, what parts of the world do we have the highest potential of increasing food production? The indications from the FAO data show that world food production must increase by 70% to be able to feed a population of 9 billion. And this has to come mostly from Africa and South Asia, whose potential for increasing production is very high, but whose actual production and productivity levels are very low today. And you could turn that around, that the challenges of food production, food security in those parts of the world offer tremendous opportunities. Now, when you look at those who are producing food today, they are not the youth. And the youth make up about 20% of the population. And in rural areas, they make up some places up to 60%. Those are the people, the generation that is going to feed the world 15, 20, 30 years from today. And if they are not given the opportunity to get into agriculture as an attractive business, as a profession, then we'll have serious problems.
And how can you persuade them to get into agriculture? Because, as you know, we're seeing so often migration of the youth to the cities where they see, well, they think they see better opportunities. How can you do it in concrete terms, persuade them that it's worthwhile making a future in agriculture?
Agriculture is the engine for economic growth. That is a given fact. Agriculture provides employment for rural populations. But you're right, the rural population do not want to stay in rural areas, not because of agriculture per se, but because the rural space lacks modern amenities, transportation, communication, schools, and what have you. So what does this mean? It means to make agriculture attractive for rural youth, you must make the rural space attractive as places where the youth want to live, where they want to go back to. And this is basically why it's important for us to transform the mindset, to change the mindset, to see agriculture as a profession, as an activity that generates income. And furthermore, to redefine the concept of agriculture beyond the growing of the food itself. Because when you look at the typical farmer in South Asia, Africa and other parts of the developing world, the average farmer is the woman with the hoe and perhaps a baby on her back. It is not attractive. But when you look at agriculture as the beginning of the process of producing food, so youth can go into agriculture or into food production, not necessarily just growing the food, but also value addition through processing, marketing, packaging, marketing, and consumer. Cities are getting overcrowded. They get frustrated. Yes, you're right. They want to move into the cities. But it is an illusion to think that by moving to urban cities, they're going to have employment. They do not have employment. When we had the food riots in 2007, 2008, where did the riots occur? In the urban areas, in the big cities, not in the rural areas. What is happening in the Middle East today? Who are the drivers of change? The youth in the big cities who are frustrated, unemployment, no jobs, no social protection. We have the opportunity today to transform the rural space, and it calls for governments at the highest level of political leadership to invest in rural development.
Now, you talked there about galvanizing governments, but we've seen, haven't we, that many governments in developing nations have actually decreased quite sharply their spending on agriculture. Is this true? What kind of figures are we talking about, and how can we persuade them that this is not the way to go about it?
Yes, that is right. About three years ago, the proportion of budgets that governments were dedicating to agriculture was very low. Now it's gone up to about 5.5, 6% globally in terms of investment in agriculture. We hope, we would like for it to get back to about 15-18%. It was close to 30% in the 1980s, and mostly in the developing world, it dropped. But fortunately, governments are beginning to listen to the call to increase investment in agriculture. You are familiar with the Maputo Declaration of 2003, where the African governments dedicated themselves to increasing their agricultural budgets by up to 10% of the annual budgets. And we are glad that about 10 countries today have been able to meet that level: Tanzania, Malawi, Ghana, Niger, and a few others.
And are you already seeing the benefits of that policy change in those countries? I talked to a minister from Malawi who said that, in fact, hunger has decreased markedly since the government decided to focus more or invest more in agriculture.
That is correct. Malawi is a success story, but also we see similar stories emerging from Tanzania and from Ghana. So governments are beginning to listen. Some governments have actually not gotten to the 10% mark, but they have made significant improvement to about 6 to 7% of their budgets to agriculture. So the change is beginning to occur.
Now, agriculture is all about growing food, and food prices have risen sharply, very sharply, over the past year, even to some record levels for some commodities. But we've heard much less about it in the mainstream media compared to during the 2007-2008 food price rises. Why has it not been talked about much this time? Why is it not getting the publicity?
Well, I think the levels that we're talking about actually have not surpassed. Is the index, the food price index, yes, is high, but in terms of actual prices of staples, at least in Africa, have not exceeded the levels of 2007. And because in Eastern Africa, where maize or corn is the staple food, they have experienced bumper harvests. In West Africa, where we're looking at things like cassava and non-grain crops, these oftentimes are not affected by international prices. The sad part of the story, actually, is that although international prices, if the impact of increase in commodities internationally only impacts much later in rural areas. And you will expect that poor farmers will be able to profit from the increase. Unfortunately, it doesn't happen that way, because farm gate prices do not immediately change. And the middlemen or middlewomen in these communities are the ones that benefit from hikes in food prices.
In 2009, Pope Benedict met and addressed IFAD's Governing Council for its 30th anniversary celebrations and praised the important work you do to promote rural development and to reduce rural poverty. How insightful were his words, and how valuable do you see the contribution that is made by church-sponsored NGOs that are working to achieve those same goals that IFAD is working for?
Yeah, we were actually very much inspired by the meeting we had with Pope Benedict and the fact that he saw articulated very well the search for food security with the search for spiritual, upliftment, spiritual security in terms of the relationships there. And interestingly enough, IFAD works with a lot of NGOs, because it's in many countries where government infrastructure and institutions are weak. We find working with NGOs oftentimes is much easier than working with communities. A good number of our activities in Latin America, for example, and parts of Africa are in collaboration with NGOs, and we do provide them with grants where there is very close alignment in terms of our own objectives and our mission, which is to enable poorer people to overcome poverty.
The Pope has often talked, and other people as well, of course, of the moral imperative of helping the world's poorest people, particularly when we see often, displays of huge wealth in the West, particularly, shall we say, in the light of the crisis. It's shone the spotlight on that. But how would you like this message to reach a wider audience of people, to make people realise how important this is?
Well, when you think about it, that every minute or so, one child dies from hunger and from disease and malnutrition. When you think of it and you realise that 40% of produce that leaves the farm does not get to the consumer because it is lost due to poor storage and post-harvest processing. And you compare that, on the other hand, that in the advanced developed world, 40% of what is not consumed is lost as waste. So you have post harvest losses in the developing world, 40%. You have post-consumer losses because people either have too much to eat and it is wasted.
Or buy too much.
It is actually a moral responsibility. We cannot continue to close our eyes to the fact that 1 billion people today go to bed every day hungry. We cannot close our eyes to the fact that there is a total lack of moral responsibility where we have 3 square meals a day and we have large population of the world that cannot even afford 1 meal in 3 days. But we have to go beyond short-term solutions. And that is why IFAD puts particular emphasis to ensure that our interventions are sustainable. We want to help poor rural people to be able to produce food not only for themselves and for their families, but enough to be able to sell to increase their economic viability. This is the most important aspect in terms of what we do.
And yet we've seen in the wake of the 2008 global economic crisis, millions more people that have joined the ranks of the poor. Do you sometimes feel you're battling against impossible odds? There's such huge needs out there and never enough funding to help everybody.
Today we are facing a more delicate and more difficult situation. Yes, food prices today may not have peaked to what they were in 2007-2008, but they are pretty close to that. We are today facing a situation where major economies are having very serious fiscal problems. And so pledges are made, they are not fulfilled. My major worry is that what we see that is happening in the North African countries, in the Middle East today, may spread to other parts of the world where the youth become restive and we then have a global crisis in our hands.
In fact, what do you see as the greatest challenge that we will face in the short term? Do you in fact see this risk of, shall we say, a youth-inspired uprising, or are there other challenges also that you see on the horizon?
Well, the youth uprising is one, and I have no way of saying what dimension that is going to take in the future, but it's very worrying because if you see the way it is spreading. The other one, of course, certainly is the financial and economic crisis, which is affecting the large economies. And the third one, of course, which is more overarching, is climate change, because climate change is going to make it even more difficult for us. And we hope the political leaders and the negotiators will be able to achieve a legally binding agreement to ensure that the rising temperatures do not exceed 2 degrees in the next 15 to 20 years. Otherwise, we'll really have serious problems because we're going to have regions of the world where there'll be extreme floods, regions of the world where there'll be extreme droughts, where it will be difficult to produce food. So we're looking at a situation which is certainly not one that one would like to see happen.
I was speaking to Kanayo Wanze, president of the UN agency IFAD.
This is really an epic moment for the whole Middle East, North Africa region, that after a century of basically quiet submission to the will of the regimes in those countries, suddenly the people, it seems like they've woken up.
An Armenian from Jerusalem, Dr. Harry Hagopian, whose voice you just heard, is a consultant on Mideast affairs for the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. His words sum up the momentous character of the unprecedented popular unrest that has swept through the Mideast and North Africa region in recent weeks. But what are the causes of this burning fuse? How will it impact on the situation of Christians living in those areas? What do these uprisings say about the West's policies towards regimes in this region? And could the unrest spread to other areas of the world? These are just some of the many questions being asked as we watch the dramatic and increasingly violent events play out in the region. I began by asking Hagopian why we're seeing such an unprecedented wave of unrest there.
Yes, I think there is a spark that actually started in Tunisia. And after years and years and decades of the citizens of the Middle East, North Africa region being pretty much voiceless, suddenly that spark in Tunisia and that first uprising in Tunisia, which was described as the Jasmine Revolution, I think that began to have some sort of a domino effect and unleashed this freedom-seeking spirit spirit within the Arab world and the North African world that were pretty much not evident for decades. And what we are seeing these days from Tunisia to Egypt to Bahrain, Libya, Yemen, and many other countries, I think is a consequence of that initial spark.
It is very much a young people's uprising, isn't it? They're the movers and shakers behind it. Because if we look at the average age of the population in many of the affected countries, a high percentage of them are under 30, aren't they? And then there's also quite a high literacy rate amongst these people.
Yes, that is true. I mean, what I've described the people in the streets, in the different squares and roundabouts, as being the Twitter and Facebook generations that have suddenly decided to take matters into their own hands. And yes, those are people who do not particularly belong to any political ideology, nor to any religious background, but are just men and women who've had enough of being second and third class citizens in their own countries and now are seeking that sense of dignity, respect and freedom that I think any human being should expect and celebrate.
Do you believe that many of the, as you said, long-standing leaders of these regimes in this area are likely to be sleeping uneasily at the moment, fearing for their continuing hold on power? Do you see some that are particularly vulnerable?
Of course. I think pretty much everybody feels vulnerable in this region. I mean, when it started initially in Tunisia, the question was whether this was a one isolated incident in a country that is lovely to visit as a tourist, but is not really at the heart of the region. However, once that revolution moved on to Egypt, the largest and most important Arab country in North Africa, I think that's when people started realizing that this is beginning to gain a momentum that could pretty much prove to be unstoppable. So in a sense, I don't think any leader in the Middle East or North Africa can sleep soundly knowing fully well that something could happen in his country. Hence why now there is this zeal for reforms in many of those countries. Now, those reforms, in my opinion, have been long overdue. But whether those reforms at this late stage might ward off any drastic changes in other countries, again, is something that we'll have to wait and see, because nobody knows where the wave will hit next.
Now, you talk about nobody knowing, of course, where the wave will hit next. But do you think it could spread beyond the Middle East and North Africa region? Or do you think there's certain factors there that are making this particularly vulnerable, or shall we say likely to have these popular uprisings?
I think in a sense, Susie, what I have often asked myself over many years is that when East Europe freed itself from the shackles of communism, when I saw movements happening in terms of social development and social justice in some African countries and also in Latin American countries, the question that I often used to ask myself, why doesn't this happen in the Middle East and North Africa? What is it about the Arab world and the Arab peoples? Is there something genetically preventing them from rising up and freeing themselves from what pretty much was a state of subjugation in many of those countries? And I could never actually get an answer to that. Was it the fear of repression? The authorities were so firmly in control of the country that people were afraid to go out in the streets? Was it a basic fatalism that is part of the culture of this vast region? I was never too sure of it, but now I've come to realize that, as we were talking just a minute ago, the initial spark which created this momentum from Tunisia onward is basically a sense of self-determination. There are many ways one could describe this, but perhaps the best way is to say that this is a sense of popular self-determination, where people power has finally come of age, and where the people of the region are basically reclaiming what is a very rich heritage that they've had in history, and saying that enough is enough. And I also believe that part of the reason why it's happening now, when I refer to the Twitter and Facebook generations, is because we have become a smaller global village. We are now so much linked that what happens in one remote corner of the world is immediately transmitted to other parts of the world. So when the citizens of this region have seen what democracy means in the United States, in Europe, in other parts of the world, then inevitably this is something I believe that has fed into their own zeal to come out and free themselves.
And how do Christians in the Mideast region fit into this equation? We know all about Christians emigrating from many areas in the Middle East. And we saw how in Egypt, you know, there were Christians out there demonstrating with the other young people in Cairo's Tahrir Square during the Egyptian uprising. Do you think they stand to gain or lose? Because look what happened in Iraq when the Christians were actually left relatively alone and unscathed during the dictatorial regime of Saddam Hussein. And now there's greater democracy, but all kinds of sectarian bloodletting has been unleashed.
I couldn't agree with you more, Susie. I mean, this is a particular worry for me and also for the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. We discuss this matter fairly frequently. And again, it's very difficult to predict which way it's going to go. It also depends on what form of state building will take place once the dust has settled down. But you're absolutely right. The plight of the Iraqi Christians is horrendous. The problems that the Coptic Christians, be they the Coptic Orthodox or the Coptic Catholic churches, have faced is equally bad over decades. So it is something that one needs to keep an eye on and to make sure that we speak out and we stress that citizenship rights does not discriminate on the basis of religion. And this is something that applies as much to Egypt as it does to Jordan, Lebanon, Iraq, and all the other countries of this vast region.
And finally, when we contemplate all this upheaval going on, is there a lesson to be learnt from this by the West, who, of course, for decades has supported somewhat autocratic regimes in the region, like, say, that in Egypt?
I think we in the West, Susie, have had a rude awakening. And a rude awakening in the sense that for many, many years, we have thought that if we support dictators and autocracies, if we basically go for security and stability, which in a sense meant keeping those rulers on their thrones or on their chairs and making sure that Islamism or political Islam does not become a factor we in the West need to deal with, we thought that that would provide us with the security and the interest we in the West need in order to have a decent life. However, what has happened now, I think, has completely shaken up that vision. And I believe that many, many European leaders and also increasingly the U.S. administration are coming to realize that they are actually in the wrong, and that what needs to be done now is to renegotiate the way we look at the Middle East, North Africa region. And of course, keeping well in mind for me as a practicing Christian that the large Christian communities which are local and indigenous to the region also retain a voice so that their rights are not trodden over as well.
Harry Hagopian, a consultant on Mideast affairs for the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Well, that's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.